Hey, welcome to Hellbent, a feminist podcast for those who resist and persist. I'm Devin.
And I'm Varsha.
And it's Thursday, which normally means it's just our... Well, actually recording on a Wednesday, which is sort of important. We'll get to why. But for the Thursday episodes, it's usually just an interview episode. I try to make the interviews that I do as timely and as salient as possible. Though Varsha and I felt this week that jumping in with a more fleshed out news section, and then I'm actually talking to Ian Millhiser again. I talked to him last week, which is, this now is way more white dudes that have ever been on this. It's the same one, but talking to him 2 weeks in a row. But he was so helpful last week in clarifying what's been going on in the Supreme Court. And I think that there's so much going on that getting his voice here again, I think will be very helpful for this discussion. It's a very confusing discussion. Legal discussions always confuse the hell out of me. So I think that he'll be very, very helpful.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the interview last Thursday. So I'm excited to hear it again. Hear him explain our collective demise. It'll be fun.
It's going to be great. Yeah. And so I think what we're going to do is we're just going to jump right in. We're going to talk about what's come out of the Supreme Court in the last couple of days. And then also what Justice Anthony Kennedy and basically what his retirement means, what he has meant on the court, and kind of how Democrats need to start getting on the level of the sentient, uncircumcised penis Mitch McConnell if we're going to beat this.
Yep.
All right, Varsha, let's jump right in. So I want to talk about, you know, yesterday when we recorded. Like, as soon as I hit the record button, that's when we got news about the Supreme Court making their ruling on the travel ban.
Yeah.
So we didn't talk about it yesterday because, I mean, it was literally happening as we were recording. So let's start with that. So the Supreme Court has a decision on the travel ban. Can you tell us about the bullshit coming out of the majority Supreme Court right now there?
Basically, what we need to understand is what the Supreme Court said. What Roberts said is, let's pretend Donald Trump isn't president. Let's pretend he didn't say the horrible things he did. If he didn't say those things, the court has no right to intervene in national security matters, right? And that's basically right. What they're saying. They're pretending that Donald Trump didn't say all of the things that he did, all of the multiple things that he did that clearly violate the Establishment Clause, that clearly violate the First Amendment, and said, because we're going to pretend those things don't really matter, we're going to say what holds in this court, what holds today, is that we cannot interfere in the national security decision of this president, right? Mm-hmm. And Justice Sotomayor was like, fuck this bullshit, right? She says, yeah.
She has words, and she also read this from the bench. And justices reading dissenting opinions from the bench is pretty rare from what I understand. And she also did not use, which I was listening, I think it was probably Maddow, but I was listening and someone was saying that usually you say, I respectfully dissent. And she was like, nope, I do not respectfully do anything. I dissent. And so, yeah, tell us what she said.
Yeah. So she says, quote, the court's decision today fails to safeguard that fundamental principle. It leaves undisturbed a policy first advertised openly and unequivocally as a, quote, total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States, unquote, because the policy now masquerades behind a facade of national security concerns. But this repackaging does little to cleanse the presidential proclamation number 9645 of the appearance of discrimination that the president's words have created. Based on the evidence in the record, a reasonable observer would conclude that the proclamation was motivated by anti-Muslim animus. It's pretty obvious. That's what she's saying. And so right. In this dissent, not only does she say all of this, she also cites Korematsu. And Korematsu was right. The case that upheld Japanese internment. She says, look, that is a historical example of racial bias that we justified based on national security. And that was wrong. And we're doing the same thing today. And Justice Roberts, being the asshole that he is like, no, Sonia Sotomayor, you're wrong for invoking Korematsu. And you know what I'm going to do? Just to stick it to you, because I think you're wrong, I'm going to declare Korematsu as now, quote unquote, bad law now. But what I am doing is just reinforcing Korematsu in another vein. And this time, it's right. Anti-Muslim bias.
Right. And Korematsu is sort of this classic Supreme Court decision in which the court said basically that the government can use whatever sort of argument it wants as long as it is under this facade, as Setemoyer said, of national security. And those words are sort of this like magic incantation almost that gets the Supreme Court to like back off immediately, right? It's in the interest of national security.
As long as it's also not just national security, but I think the term they use is facially neutral. Stuff like Plessy versus Ferguson, separate like that, which created Separate but Equal, a bunch of other horrific court cases. What they've said is, oh, it was facially neutral. And that's when like they made that horrible decision. They're like, oh, because it's facially neutral, I have to decide that this does not violate the First Amendment. Even though we obviously know in 2018, it's not facially neutral, right? And that's what Justice Roberts is doing.
It's interesting because you can't even really use the argument where I haven't heard this. I'm spitballing a little bit here. But you could say, okay, in the 40s, when Korematsu was decided, there was less opportunity to know the intent of the lawmakers a lot of the time, because there was no instant news service, right? You got your news from the radio, from the newspaper. It was a slower churning. And so, okay, I actually haven't even heard someone make that argument, but I was thinking about this today and I was thinking, okay, so let's say that that's the case. So we're talking about facially neutral. Then you could maybe say that at least in Korematsu or Plessy or some of these other cases, maybe taking intent into consideration was more difficult because of the limited access people and even Supreme Court justices had to information. We are in the age of fucking information. We are in the 24-hour news cycle. We are in the age of Twitter, where every time the president takes a shit, he feels the need to open up his Twitter app on his unsecure phone and tweet about whatever the fuck he's thinking about. And so to say that you can make something facially neutral in this age of information is patently false, really. And it's also just the doublethink being held here to make that argument is absolute and utter bullshit.
It's complete bullshit. And this is what I listened to the interview last week with Ian, right? And I really agreed with the fact that he said this is the most partisan court he's ever seen. Right. Because it's not just that, you know, you have conservative ideologues and liberal ideologues in the court. You have conservatives on the court who will do whatever the fuck they want to support the Republican Party. Because not only did they say, you know, the First Amendment doesn't really apply to this Muslim ban, they said the First Amendment does apply to this fucking cake baker who doesn't want to support gay rights, right?
Well, here's where Sotomayor comes in and is like, I'm going to further rip you to shreds because I'm a motherfucking badass. So she called out Kennedy specifically in her dissenting opinion. She said, quote, in holding that the First Amendment gives way to an executive policy that a reasonable observer would view as motivated by animus against Muslims, the majority opinion upends this court's precedent, repeats tragic mistakes of the past, and denies countless individuals the fundamental right of religious liberty. Just weeks ago, the court rendered its decision in Masterpiece Cake Shop, which applied the bedrock principles of religious neutrality and tolerance in considering a First Amendment challenge to government action. Those principles should be applied equally here. In both instances, the question is whether a government actor exhibited tolerance and neutrality in reaching a decision that affects individuals' fundamental religious freedom. But unlike in Masterpiece, where a state civil rights commission was found to have acted without, quote, the neutrality that the Free Exercise Clause requires, unquote, the government actors in this case will not be held accountable for breaching the First Amendment's guarantee of religious neutrality and tolerance. Unlike in Masterpiece, where the majority considered the state's commissioner's statements about religion to be persuasive evidence of unconstitutional government action, the majority here have completely set aside the president's charged statements about Muslims as irrelevant. That holding erodes the foundational principles of religious tolerance that the court elsewhere has so emphatically protected, and it tells members of minority religions in our country that they, quote, are outsiders, not full members of the political community. I'm pretty sure Justice Sotomayor is my favorite justice, as I talked about with Ian on Thursday. Scathing. Like she not only ripped the majority opinion as a whole to shreds, she went after Kennedy specifically and ripped him to shreds.
Yeah, because I also think she probably knew that he was going to make this teeny tiny little announcement today. And she was like, fuck this shit. And it's just, that's what's really frustrating about this is that there has, you know, progressives or liberals, we talk about how progress happens over time, right? But I see no difference with this travel ban decision, with decisions like Korematsu, Plessy versus Ferguson, Dred Scott, etc. There's like no difference. It's clear that a set of justices have decided who matters, which religion and matters, and which doesn't. They have clearly decided who is a second-class citizen in this country, who is a second-class person, and that is Muslims. And who is a first-class person? Someone who is the president. Someone who is white, someone who is Christian, someone who's evangelical. Like, they have decided who matters. And that is what's just so profoundly fucked up, is that they're not even trying to hide it anymore. I'm not saying they tried to hide it before, but it's just blatant, because it's been less than a week since like the Masterpiece, or 2 weeks since the Masterpiece Cake Shop. And now you have this. And then we have another decision to talk about that totally fucks with this again. So it's just, it's so frustrating, and it's so obviously partisan and so obvious a hack job that it just makes – it fills me with rage.
Mm. Well, this is something that I actually did ask Ian about at our last interview on Thursday, was the existential question of, we like to think, or at least we like to believe, that judges and justices and people in those positions of power are – if not neutral, at least objective, although I still believe objectivity is a myth, but I won't get into that right now. But the fact of the matter is that they're not. And if we keep coming from this place where we think that these justices are acting within a bubble, or that they're somehow immune to the whims of the 24-hour news cycle in this day and age, like, we're drunker than we look. Like, we have to stop thinking that that's the case. We have to stop talking about Supreme Court justices as somehow neutral or objective. You know, whether we like it or not, this is partisan, and these decisions, all of these decisions we're about to talk about, were on a 5-4 basis, with the majority being done by justices that were appointed by Republican presidents, and then therefore track as Republican or conservative justices. So,
here's a fun statistic that I learned today. In the past few elections, since 1988, Democrats have won the popular vote in a presidential election 6 out of 7 times. But for some reason, we only have 4 out of 9 justices. Why is that? Mitch McConnell, that should supplement the thing that you said, that, you know, justices aren't this objective, neutral force in our history. To supplement that, I just want to point out the partisan history of how we even appoint these fucking justices.
Oh, yeah. And they never fucking have been. And we just need to let that go. There are two other cases that I want to talk about, at least briefly. The first one is Janus. So Janus versus the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. And it was decided in favor of Mark Janus, who can go fuck himself, who argued, quote, this is from the New York Times, argued he should not have to pay a fee to the union that represented employees at his workplace on First Amendment grounds. So Alito, for the majority, agreed with this and said, quote, agency fees cannot be upheld on the ground that they promote an interest in labor peace. So basically saying, you can say, I don't want to pay these fees because of your First Amendment rights, and that you cannot be forced to do so to promote this interest of labor peace.
And this is why this is such bullshit, because if this happens, which is now, like, this is now the Supreme Court's ruling, that means money is free speech, as we have learned in Citizens United, and now money is forcing speech here. It could be said in the future, money could be forcing speech in a bunch of other ways. So me paying, my business paying for your insurance is forcing me to pay for your breast cancer treatment, or if you're gay or something, my fees towards your union or whatever shouldn't be helping support your lifestyle. There's like so many other ways this could like fuck up civil rights and not just union rights. But just in this one case, what this case was about, Mark Janus doesn't give a fuck about, you know, what this means for Republican politics in the future or anything like that. He just was a cheapskate who didn't want to pay his fees, right? He was an imbecile who thought that his union was doing political lobbying with his money, which is already illegal. They were not doing that. What this case was about was right-wing groups finding a way to destabilize any group that supports Democrats. That's why you have right-to-work states. Unions usually support Democrats.
Right. Well, and I also think that you're absolutely right, though, and these these conservative special interest groups that were looking for a case to bring to the Supreme Court. Because like you said, Janice doesn't give a fuck. Although he is welcome to take a long walk off of a short pier, as far as I'm concerned. But I think you're absolutely right, though. These groups are looking for cases that are laying the foundation work or laying the framework to create arguments to bring to the Supreme Court that further this idea that with money as free speech and as we work within a free market enterprise system, using money as a free speech as an argument to then further limit the rights of people. So to say, right, like a company paying, you know, for health insurance, but they don't want to cover what we already talked about, birth control, who don't want to cover certain types of healthcare, who don't want to cover, you know, things that they believe are, they are exercising their First Amendment right to free speech by either giving or withholding that money. So Janice is awful for unions and labor peace, to quote Alito, but it's also awful because it's going to be used as a runway for a lot of these types of cases to argue money as free speech, which, as we saw with Citizens United, is a path directly into hell. So
yeah,
it's going to be slippery. And that's one I think we really have to keep our eye on in terms of cases that we see being argued coming down the pike.
Yeah. And it also, like, just profoundly fucks me over because I'm a grad student and member of my union at Berkeley. And this means that, like, all the people who don't pay into the union fees who are grad students at Berkeley now don't have to. And the union there is in the middle of a negotiation. So it fucks over a bunch of UC Berkeley students who teach a bunch of other undergrads. And it's a horrific ruling. And it just fucks over so many people. And it's the reason it's bad is because it's not as if, you know, these right-wing arguments that these unions were politically lobbying or just arms of the Democratic Party, that's not true anymore. As you've seen in 2016, there are a lot of union members who voted for Donald Trump. It's not as if, like, the union machine itself is going for Democratic candidates. That's illegal. The reason this is also destabilizing is now it means that, like, these unions don't have enough money to basically leverage and negotiate anything. And so now it hurts everyone, not just the people who don't pay the fees, but the people who do pay the fees. So it's all around shit for everyone. By the way, in any case, yeah, if anyone was wondering, I do pay my union fees. I have since the beginning. I just want to make that clear.
Yeah. Okay. So, and then the last case that I want to talk about before we talk about Dickwad of the Forever Kennedy is the case, the National Institute of Family and Life Advocates versus Becerra. So this is a case that originated from California AG Xavier Becerra against the NIFLA, which runs crisis pregnancy centers. So as many of us know, crisis pregnancy centers are non-medical facilities that try to get women to come to and make sure that they don't get abortions. So yep. The California has a law, or did until this decision, had a law that said crisis pregnancy centers must disclose what they are, what services they offer, and what services they don't offer, and must also provide information to their clients about abortion services and other medical services available to them, even if they're not available at that crisis pregnancy center. So what the NIFLA was arguing was that was a violation of their free speech, and being forced to give information on a legal and safe medical procedure was tantamount to undermining their right to free speech as Christians. I'm not making that up. That was the actual argument. I am not making that up.
You know where this leads? If the Hippocratic Oath, like, didn't exist, this leads to where, like, Christian doctors in certain areas of the country can say, yeah, I'm just going to lie to my female patients about whether or not they're pregnant until, like, the fifth month. Or I'm just going to lie to people about whether or not they can get an abortion or not, or whether they can get this prescription or not. That's what this means. And I know that this specific case is just about non-licensed medical centers, but this is basically giving, like, free rein to these centers in California to say, yeah, we're just going to, like, rope in all of these women and then lie to them. And then we're not really breaking any laws because free speech allows me to lie to people. What the fuck is regulation for?
Well, right. And the thing about these crisis pregnancy centers and the reason why California had these laws in place in the first place was because a lot of these crisis pregnancy centers don't disclose to their patients that they are not licensed medical facilities. A lot of these places, the people working there wear lab coats so that they look like doctors and nurses, even though they do not offer any sort of medical service. And so basically these regulations were put in place to make sure that those who went to those crisis pregnancy centers were aware of the type of facility that they were at. It wasn't about whether or not people could go to them. It wasn't about whether or not women had the choice to go to a crisis pregnancy center or to not get an abortion. It was about basically informed consent and informing the people who went to these centers what these centers were and what specifically what they are not. And so now basically the Supreme Court is saying, nah, lie by omission. That's fine. That's free speech. That's a thing that's important to us. And all of this bullshit, I mean, I understand that the First Amendment right and the right to free speech is the most classically American and also classically complicated right that we have. You know, this has been a debate forever. What is free speech? What is it not? What are its limitations? But the fact of the matter is all three of these cases we've talked about deal directly with free speech. And they all come down on the side of free speech only applies to some people. Or in the case of Janice, only applies to some types of money.
Yep.
And I think that is really, I think what was very overwhelming when I was reading about these three cases is that they were quite different cases, right? Unions, crisis pregnancy centers, and a travel ban / actually a Muslim ban. But that they all boiled down to the same thing, and that the court was basically saying, we get to decide who has free speech, and that it's not for everyone.
It's really frustrating because there might be another way for California to pass another law that tweaks this or something like that. And, you know, our AG and our next governor, as long as they're Democrat, are going to continue fighting for women in our state. But this means that, like, this could continue happening in other states where restrictions are not as severe as in California. And they're not even that severe in California. Yeah, because all they were asking these pregnancy centers to do was to say, one, I am not a licensed medical center, and two, hey, you may be able to get these services or not get these services at other Medicaid or, you know, California Medicaid-based places that, like, might give you more money or, you know, support you more than this place because we don't take certain insurance because, again, we're not a medical center, right? So it wasn't advocating, hey, you're pregnant, go get an abortion. It was just saying, if you wanted one, this right. is where you should go, but you don't have to get one. So, like, they weren't even being restricted into convincing them or lying to them to make them not get an abortion. They just had to say, these are all of the options available to you. And so you would think that, somebody who, you know, conservative justices who enjoy freedom and enjoy people getting all the information that they deserve because they are free and they're autonomous, their bodies are autonomous, you would think that they want that from unlicensed medical centers. But no, they just hate abortion and women that much.
And so, and I like what you said there is like, look, California, we've got Becerra, you know, it's very likely we're going to have a Democratic governor. We continue as a state to fight this shit day after day. You know, our AG office is like one big Trump fighting machine at this point. But this is going to have broader ramifications for other states, for other places that maybe wanted to put regulations like this in place, but didn't, and now really can't. And it really binds the scope of what a state government can do. And that's always, you know, that's the old adage, like Republicans are all about small government until they're in power. And then all of a sudden the government gets to tell you what to do and who has access to free speech and who does not.
Yeah.
Okay. I want to now talk about Anthony Kennedy and
good old Tony.
Good old Tony is retiring. And I would just like to start this by saying every single person who didn't vote for Hillary Clinton can fuck right off into a fire.
Oh, because yeah.
The Supreme Court was on the ballot. We all knew it was on the ballot. We knew As soon as I said before, sentient uncircumcised penis Mitch McConnell refused to give Merrick Garland a hearing, that the Supreme Court was on the ballot. We knew that this spot was being held open for Trump. And now with Kennedy retiring, we knew that Kennedy was going to retire. People have been talking about it.
Or we knew that Breyer or RBG could die, right? Or pass away, right? Like, so we knew it could happen. And like, there were potentially 4 Supreme Court justices on this ballot. Scalia's old seat before Trump won, Kennedy, Breyer, and RBG. Clarence Thomas could retire. Like, there are a bunch of other people who could retire. So we knew this was on the fucking line. So I have a list, like Arya Stark, in my head of all the assholes who told me, Varsha, I can't vote for Hillary Clinton just because she's like the lesser of two evils. I have to keep my standards, right? I have to keep my priorities straight, and my ideological purity just cannot allow me to vote for Hillary Clinton. Fuck all of you. You can fuck right the fuck off. You suck, and you are partially to blame for all of this shit. You, including James Comey, Mitch McConnell for not releasing information about Russia before the election, all of us are partly to blame. Like, I'm partly to blame because I could have done more, but you are definitely to blame because you fucked up. You fucked us over for over a generation.
Yeah. Well, so that's the thing. And that's where, for me, when people talk about voting for Trump, and I have talked about this a lot because I obviously have – I've talked about it before. I have family who voted for Trump. And everyone always talks about the economic side of it and economic anxiety. And you know, my rich in-laws wanting the tax breaks that Trump had promised. And so, but this right here, this moment, this morning, is why voting for Trump was so dangerous. And while even if you did it for economic reasons, the implicit racism and sexism and disdain for compassion and empathy, it was not just short-sighted and cruel. It is devastating for generations. Because with Kennedy's retirement, the Republican Party is going to try to get in some young conservative ideologue that is not going to retire or pass away for 50 years. And so we're talking about 2-3 generations of people who are looking at a court that is not against discrimination of LGBTQ citizens, who are trying to take away women's rights to their own bodies. I don't even want to know what it's going to look like when the Supreme Court hears the case about separating these kids at the border. And I'm really not being a fatalist here. Like, this is a big fucking deal. And I put this on my Facebook, and I know that there are not many Trump supporters that listen to this podcast, but I am going to pose this question. If you voted for Trump for economic reasons, would you be willing to tell me the sum of money that you received, or that you think you will receive or have received through these draconian tax policies designed to favor the rich? I want to know if that was enough, for you to disregard the basic humanity of other people. And honestly, I really just want to know the price of your soul. I want to know how much it costs to buy, because I think that we really need to stare that in the face. And we really need to look at the people who did this and say, your soul is for sale. You might as well tell me how much it costs.
Yeah. I whenever I do like end up talking to somebody who is a Trump supporter, it doesn't happen often. It's only happened a couple times, and I won't like name names or anything. It's like, I always try to keep calm, and I always just try to like trip them up in the fact that they are basically saying, but all that didn't matter because Gorsuch, but all that doesn't matter because of this tax cut, or because of supply side economics, right? And I'm just like, you're literally discounting thousands of lives, because it's not just Roe v. Wade that's going to be fucked over by Kennedy retiring. Yeah. It is also voting rights. It is also any kind of campaign finance reform ever, or any kind of campaign finance legislation that even exists right now. Unions are even really more screwed than they are now. If Trump wants to pass another travel ban, go for it. There are so many other things. Gerrymandering. We're never going to get fixed on partisan gerrymandering now. Like, we maybe thought Kennedy might be on our side, but now that he's retired, there is no way the fifth justice that the justice that Trump appoints is going to be in favor of ending partisan gerrymandering, right? So we are like literally fucked for 30 to 40 years. And at some point, this is going to bite some Trump voter in the ass. If it hasn't already, at some point, they are going to turn to a certain age where they can't collect their Social Security, or they're not eligible for Medicare, or their kid or somebody is screwed over by a Trump policy or a Supreme Court ruling, right? And so at some point, I just want them to realize that this affected them too. It wasn't just about money for them. And I'm just saying, like, it's going to affect them. Just like any law or any kind of Supreme Court ruling, like, you think it's not going to affect you. Like when it comes to like Obergefell or Janus or something, you think, oh, I'm not gay, or I'm not in a public sector union, this won't affect me. Down the line, at some point, every type of policy affects you. You don't have to be a woman to be affected by abortion. You just have to live in society, because when women don't live in a society where their human rights are respected, it doesn't feel good, and it's not going to lead to good consequences for these women and the men in their lives, right? And so this is – it's not just the decisions that this new justice is going to make that's going to fuck us over. It's also so many other little things that this like leads towards. So fuck Anthony Kennedy.
Well, yeah, so that's kind of what I said on yesterday's episode as well. It was basically like, if you don't think that these sort of unbridled power grabbing policies that are directed at brown people right now are coming for you, then I have a bridge to sell you. Like I said, like, if you don't think these will eventually get to you, if you think this can happen to them and not me, you haven't been paying attention. In the words of Ian Millizer, who I get to speak to again on Think Progress, quote, "It was fun having anti-discrimination laws while it lasted," because that's really what we're staring down the barrel of. And anti-discrimination laws, you know, you think of that and you automatically have, you know, most people have this thing in their head like, oh, that's for black people or women or LGBT community, or, you know, discrimination doesn't really have anything to do with me. I'm not discriminated against. But you know what? One day it's going to have something to do with you or your kid or your partner or your best friend. It is going to happen. And when it does, I want you to really take a long, long look in the mirror and say, I did this. I'm the cause of this person's pain. I'm the cause of my own pain, because I othered people. And I said, you can do it to them, not to me. Not to spoil the ending to 1984, but that's the ending to 1984.
Yeah.
Is they finally break him by getting him to say, no, stop, don't do it to me, do it to her. That was the ending.
And that's basically why I want them to realize this. Not because I'm petty, like I am petty, but I also want them to like at some point go, I don't have to make this decision again. There are people out there. Like, I'm not talking about those horrific people who voted for Trump because they're just out racist. I'm talking to people who maybe voted for Trump but voted for Obama before, or maybe just sat out 2016, or maybe don't vote in midterms or don't vote at all. Those people at some point are going to realize, oh, like, I had a role to play in 2016 and I fucked up, but I'm not going to fuck up again. Right. And I just want that realization, not just because like I want people who voted for Trump to be screwed over. Like, I don't want that. That's not American of me. I want people to realize they were screwed over so they don't make the decision again. You know, it's not about being petty. It's about changing hearts and minds to realize, oh, I have a say in what my life looks like. And the first way to have a say in is to vote for people who aren't going to fuck me over.
Right. Well, yeah. And I we talked a little bit about that too, kind of this idea of like, for me, a big part of my self-care has been letting go of the ideological purity. I think that if you voted for Jill Stein or sat out or wrote in Bernie Sanders or whatever, if you did any of those things, really, you can go fuck right off. But at the same time, if you then come back and say, wait, I really, really fucked up here. Like, I do not need to apply my ideological purity test to you that you applied to Hillary Clinton. That is the meaning of empathy.
Yeah.
That is me opening my heart and saying, that's what you thought. You had a purity test so stringent that Hillary Clinton didn't pass it. So I can do the same thing. I can say, my purity test is so stringent that I don't want your help. Or I can say, you know what? You made that mistake. I'm not going to make that mistake. Let's fix this together. And I'll just side eye you a little bit and judge you silently. That's fine. Judge silently. I am all for that. Yep. But if you open your mouth, make sure it's something kind and empathetic coming out of it.
And that's basically my deal with this. Like,
as we come up against the, you know, nominating another Supreme Court justice, I expect the Democratic senators to stop playing by these rules. Look, Sarah was fond of saying it's like Democrats are still playing cards when the Republicans have set the House on fire.
Yeah.
Which, yes, that is a very valid criticism of the Democratic Party. We absolutely do that because we believe in these weird things like, you know, precedent and civility. And civility is a kind of a hot word. But we believe in things like rule of law and like order and playing by the rules and fairness. But you know what? When it comes to Supreme Court justice, the only rule is that there are no rules. Right? If you as a Democratic senator have to physically lay your body down on the floor to stop a Supreme Court justice from getting a hearing like Mitch McConnell did, I expect you to do it. I'm not kidding. If you have to sit your butt down and physically not move, if you have to pull every dirty trick in the book, then this is your job. This is your moment. This is why you were elected. You know,
again, this is one of those
things. Yeah, this is the only thing that matters. Again, this is one of those things. And I never thought I'd say it once in a lifetime, let alone twice. But just like with the taking children away from their parents thing, take this in a vacuum. We need to take all the help we can get. We need to get on the same page and we need to stop this because we can. Yeah. This is a moment that feels helpless. But the fact of the matter is that it's not. It just means we've got to fight even harder. And I think that this is a good segue into our next section called, what the fuck are we going to do about this?
Yeah, I just wanted to quickly, like, my favorite quote from Veep is what Selena says once. It's like, the rule book's been torn up and America's, like, wiping its nasty ass with it. That is what Mitch McConnell did when he didn't give Merrick Garland a hearing. That is what Mitch McConnell did when he didn't let Obama tell everyone that Russia was fucking with the election before the election actually happened, right? And so Mitch McConnell doesn't give a fuck about your rules, right? Everyone online is talking about how Murkowski and Collins are, you know, pretty pro-choice, at least more pro-choice than their colleagues. So they might be able to move, right? They might not vote for this guy. And again, I don't have a lot of hope in them, but I am going to, like, get everyone I fucking know in Maine to call their senator, right? And so that's what you have to do. And when it comes to what Democrats have to do, I don't care if you think you're going to lose your election because of this one vote. It's not going to happen, right? Like, Republicans are still going to run every stupid ass ad against you to unseat you in 2018. So right. Just vote for it. At this point, I think there's like at least 15 or 20 Democrats who've already said, I'm not voting for anybody on this pre-approved list that Trump released before the election. We just got to get that number up to 49. Because even if like Joe fucking Manchin or Doug Jones votes for the Supreme Court, like, Justice, we're done. We didn't deserve to fight. Like, if Chuck Schumer doesn't whip up these votes, like, Chuck, if you're listening, this is not the bank lobbyist bill. Like, that was bad. This is like 50 times worse, man. You got to get your caucus in line. They all have to vote against this, especially every Dem on the Judiciary Committee, especially anytime this comes up for vote. And I think the best way to do this is to keep putting pressure until it breaks and the midterm elections happen, if that is possible. Again, Mitch McConnell might not let it happen, but if it's possible, push it off until after the elections. And if we take back the Senate, I'm not saying hold the seat open for 2 years. I mean, I would like that. But
I mean, I'm not saying don't not hold the seat open
for
2 years.
But at the very least, what you could do now that you would control the Senate, if we did control it after November, is force Donald Trump to nominate more and more centrist options until you get to somebody who is maybe just a little bit right to Merrick Garland, right? At least at that point, you're not fucking over America as much as you would if you just let Mitch McConnell nominate Gorsuch 2.0 today. And also, at the end of the day, like, I know it's a long shot, just like stopping Neil Gorsuch was basically impossible, this is basically impossible, but Democratic senators, like, if you don't try, we are going to remember this for a lifetime. Just like I curse Joe Lieberman every night when I realize we don't have a public option, like, I will curse every single one of you, because there are three Democratic senators who voted for Neil Gorsuch. You all suck.
You all suck, and I will never forget it. Yeah. Well, and so that's the thing. And this is also going – it's also going to take some courage,
yeah,
right? You have to – as a person, as a senator – Senators that I love, you know, Democratic, progressive, left-leaning, Kamala Harris, people, these are all amazing people. And their biggest character flaw and their biggest downfall is all the same, is that nobody becomes a senator because they don't think they're great. They think they're great. They love power. They think they're the best. They think they're the smartest. That's what gets you into that position. So that means that their big downfall is pride. And their big downfall is the fear that they're going to lose that power. And so I urge all of the Democratic senators, I urge them to look very carefully at this. And if you're worried about losing your seat, and that's why you are maybe hesitant to burn this shit to the ground, I implore you to have the courage to give up your seat to do the right thing. And I know that's a big ask. I know that's a big ask. I know, especially for people who think that they're the best in the whole world and that's why they became senators.
Yeah.
But maybe have the courage to give it up, to burn it down. And it's – I'm asking a lot.
Yeah. Tom Perriello, he always tells this story, but he was a congressperson in Virginia, right? And in 2010, right, he took the vote and supported the Affordable Care Act. Or 2009, he took the vote and voted for the Affordable Care Act, and then he lost his seat in 2010, right? And he tells he would happily do it over again. If he knew back in 2009 that he was lose his seat in voting for the Affordable Care Act, he said he would do it again and again and again, because that voting, yeah, for that gave insurance to 20 million people. Or
right.
And so senators, if you are from West Virginia or from California or from New York, really think, why did my voters vote for me? Why did any of my constituents vote at all? And even if they didn't vote for me, what do they want in life? And what they want in life is a justice who is going to respect their voting rights, respect reproductive rights, respect the right of anyone to freely assemble, respect the Establishment Clause, respect freedom of religion, right? And so they're basic things that anyone in this country should respect. And a senator really should think carefully about that before they go, but my norms, I can't not vote for a justice. What about the norms? This is not 20 years ago when Kennedy was appointed, right, 97-0. That is not the world we are living in today. We are living in a totally different world right now. And they really have to take that into context. And that's why Democrats across the country have to just keep calling their senators every single day.
Yep. Yeah, even if, maybe especially if you already live in a state like California where you've got DeFi and Kamala Harris, my message to them that their offices have already heard from me is, be braver than your predecessors.
Yeah. Do more than the bare minimum. Right now, I would say, I love Kamala Harris, right? But right now, her and DeFi are technically doing the bare minimum. They've already said they're not going to vote for any of these nominees. But what they could be doing more is every day on that Senate floor, lobbying other Democrats who are on the fence, lobbying Republicans. Even if Republicans are always going to say no to them or shush them away, they could be doing more. And that's why Democrats across California have to keep calling them. Just do not stop. At least once a day, till all of your friends, open up the Facebook app, message everyone, just spam all of them to call their senators and tell them no. Let's just see how much of a spine Jeff Flake really has. LOL, I know he doesn't have a spine, but let's just treat. Let's just see. Let's just push it.
I'm just messing with you. Let's push it.
Yeah, let's push it as far as it can go and see if it actually breaks or if he's just jelly.
Yeah, exactly. And I wish... Here's what I wish. Kennedy, because he knew he was going to retire, I wish that he had gone out in a blaze of glory.
Yeah.
If he had gone out guns blazing, screaming fuck you at Trump, because Ian Millhiser also said on Think Progress, quote, Anthony Kennedy was a horrible justice and his last decision was his worst. But he could have just, again, if you know you're retiring, if you know you're leaving, burn it down, right? Like, if he wrote this tortured concurring opinion about the travel ban, basically saying he didn't like it, he didn't like to vote this way. Oh my God, my conscience. Fuck that. You're going to retire anyway. Be like, you know what? Fuck it. This sucks. Trump sucks. You suck. I'm leaving anyway.
Yeah, because
I don't get why people don't do that.
What he could have done, and again, I am not a lawyer. I don't play one on TV. But what Kennedy could have done is he could have sided with the liberal justices on the travel ban and said and written a really narrow opinion that just focused on this one issue of the Establishment Clause and this one travel ban and this one issue of Trump's language. And that way he could have had his cake and eaten it too. And his cake is, I don't like to interfere in presidents when they make national security decisions. And he could have eaten it by saying, but Donald Trump is obviously a racist. Because I just know that, like, again, like, I'm not saying Kennedy is a liberal, because he definitely is not. He is not a liberal. No. There is no two ways about this. But I do think reading that concurring opinion, it was clear that he knew that Donald Trump is a fucking racist. He just didn't want to say it because it hurt my feelings. Like, I don't understand.
Yeah.
Right?
Not sure. Unclear, but basically he's a dick. And he basically wrote this concurring opinion to make himself feel better and make himself feel better that he took away the rights of so many people. So he wrote it so we can sleep at night, to which I say, you have no right to be able to sleep at night, Anthony Kennedy.
Yeah, I think another thing just to keep in mind, if people are calling their senators, like, one reason for senators to wait for hearings until after the election is because the McConnell rule, quote unquote, when he held up a hearing for a year and a half almost for Merrick Garland. Another really important reason that not a lot of people are talking about, the president is under criminal investigation. Like, he might.
No, that's a good point.
He's doing fucking crimes every fucking day. He's profiting off of his businesses. His cronies in the government are doing crimes every fucking day. This is like giving Richard Nixon a justice appointment like 2 days before his impeachment hearing in the House, right? I don't remember exactly when Nixon got his justices, right? But if 2 days into the impeachment hearing, one of the justices in the Supreme Court died, I don't think the Senate back then would have given Nixon another appointee. You know what I mean? That's basically another case you can make to your Democratic and Republican senators. Hey, why don't we just wait until this report Mueller releases? If Mueller does say that Donald Trump has done no crimes in his whole life, sure, nominate the Grim Reaper for the Supreme Court. I don't care.
But, go ahead and nominate the Grim Reaper. Go for
but
it.
But on like, the off chance that the president is a criminal, maybe we should wait. Right. And so, like, there's multiple ways to make this argument. I just think Democrats should go guns blazing into this. And I do think I agree with you, like, Devin, that some Democrats who are not up for a re-election 2018, they have to be even braver, like even louder. Like, they have to really take the hits for the rest of the caucus. That way, at least the rest of the caucus can pretend, oh, I didn't really say a lot of things about it, but still quietly vote against any Trump justice. Also, just want to say, be like Mazie Hirono. She doesn't vote for any of these fucking justices, not in the committee, not in the vote. Like, just be like her.
Be like, everybody be more like Mazie Hirono immediately, and the world will be better.
I'm in a very ranty mood today. I'm sorry.
I totally get it. I am too. And I want to close before the interview that I'll be doing tomorrow morning. I do want to close on this one Twitter thread, and shout out to Monique from Dickwads Be Gone, who posted in the Facebook group. Facebook group is great, especially if you're feeling really down and not being able to deal with this. We support each other like fuck over there, and it's great. So there's this really, really long Twitter thread by Dr. Tachanda Prescott Weinstein. I'm not going to read the whole thing because it is literally 3 pages long, but we will link to it and it is fantastic. I'm just going to read the first part of it because this was really heartening to me. And this is not heartening to me in the way that it's this like Pollyanna pants, things always get better, but it's more about there are always people who are fighting. And as long as one person is fighting, we haven't lost. So she said, quote, I tweeted this earlier today, but just going to say it again. Abolitionists lost every single SCOTUS case, every single one. John Brown failed, and chattel slavery is over now. I truly hope violent conflict isn't in our future, but we need to stop taking everything like the apocalypse is a guarantee. The rights of people have not depended on the decisions of the courts. Like the other branches of the political system, the courts have recognized these rights only after citizens have engaged in direct action. I want to call on folks who do social studies, ethnic studies, movement studies, and who may consider themselves elders to think today about writing something that shares with neophytes and younger people how movements overcame challenges and some of the worst human rights abuses. I don't know if Dr. Martin Luther King truly saw the promised land, but saying that he had helped carry people through some tremendously difficult movements and allowed them to keep going and doing work that materially improved people's lives. So she goes on from there to talk about all of the ways these movements have shaped and changed. And, you know, she said, movements are for when we lose, not when we win. And it's the hard thing to say, but as long as we're fighting, we haven't lost. And I think that that is so, so important. And again, not to spoil the ending of 1984, which was a very depressing book, but the ending was basically you lose when you stop fighting. You lose when you say, do it to someone else, I'm done.
Yeah.
And so as long as we don't say I'm done, we will win.
Yeah. And I know I am a historian in training and I shouldn't make simplistic historical analogies, but this is very similar to World War II in the sense of, like, when you think of Vichy collaborationists and other collaborators with the Nazi regime, like, that's what they were thinking. There's a great book on this by Dayak, and he basically goes through, like, the different types of people who collaborated with the Nazis during and after the war. And there are people who are just outright fucking Nazis. They're just the fucking worst. And there are people who are just trying to survive. And that is exactly what, like, 1984 is talking about years later, is like, when it's published, is that there are certain people who are just trying to survive and they are really self-interested and they're only going to focus on themselves. That's not going to help in a movement. If you want people to take care of you in the future, you're going to have to pitch in. And I think that's, like, the only thing you can do to stop this right now, because at this point, there are a lot of people collaborating with the Trump regime to do whatever the fuck they want. There's evangelicals, there's the Koch brothers, because evangelicals hate the fact that Donald Trump is a cheater. The Koch brothers hate the fact that Donald Trump hates immigration, right? There are a bunch of reasons, a variety of Republican groups dislike Donald Trump, but they're all collaborating with him because, but Gorsuch, because, but tax cut, because, but anything, right? And so there's a lot of reasons people are supporting Donald Trump. And if the only way you're going to chip away at that is to really just get in a giant fucking tent. So, like, as of this day, like, I'm just saying, like, I'm absolving anyone personally. It's a personal absolvement. Like, if you voted the wrong way in 2016, I'm absolving you, as long as you're going to do the right thing in 2018. It's even more important than 2020. Like, 2020, like, is really, really important. But at this point, 2018 is the most important election of your life. And if you do the right thing,
absolutely,
you have a personal absolvement. For me, I don't know what that's going to mean in the afterlife, but it'll probably mean a lot. Like, just saying. Right, right.
You know, but I do want the takeaway to at least sort of be, we are still fighting and we're still here. And honestly, if nothing else, we have already won because of that. We already have the empathy that so many others lack. And any movement we can make, any progress we can make, it might not be enough, but that doesn't mean it's nothing.
Yeah. I just want to share a funny story. Like, I was in the archives, like, researching, right, when my phone starts blowing up, and that's right at the point where Kennedy has decided he's going to announce retiring. And because I can't control myself, I, like, yell out, like, fuck. Not, like, really loudly, but, like, pretty loudly. And the person who's supposed to be watching everyone in the archives, like, the person who's monitoring everyone, is, like, looks up at me. And then, like, he looks at me, like, looking at my phone. And then he sort of realizes and he just nods and, like, goes on doing what he does. And he also had his phone in his hand. Like, everyone collectively realizes how horrible this is. Now it's a time for action. It's, like, it's the only thing you can do to keep yourself safe. And also just take care of yourself. Haven't felt this alone since the days of the travel ban and since November 8th, right? And this is, like, a really bad fucking day for me. So I'm just, like, taking care of myself. That's, like, the only thing that's getting through this. I did, as soon as I came home, I did take a shot of tequila. But after that, I had some tea. I'm not kidding. I had to.
I had to. It was bad.
I spent like 6 hours staring at documents and like freaking out in my head, a bunch of different scenarios. Like, I was like, oh, what if Jeff Flakes votes no? What if Collins votes no? What if McCain comes back from Arizona and votes yes, right? So there's like a bunch of scenarios going in my head. But then at the end of the day, I realized after my shot of tequila, the only thing I can do is call my senator every single day and get all of my friends to call their senators every single day until this vote happens. That's the only thing you can do.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. And afternoon tequila.
Yes.
No judgment from me.
Yes. It was after 5 p.m. somewhere.
So yeah. You're fine. Yeah, you're fine. All right. Well, thank you so much, Varsha. Varsha and I will be back here on Monday. And please join us on our Facebook group, Dick Wads Be Gone. Get involved. Talk to us. We're all here for each other. And know that we're going to keep fighting.
Yeah. Also, there is a protest for keeping families together this Saturday, I think, June 30th. So see if there's one in your area. Because yes, that story is still happening. Yes. Just because Kennedy has fucked us up doesn't mean 2,500 kids have not been kidnapped from their parents.
That's true. June 30th, there's one downtown LA that I will be at, so you can look for me. And we will see you again on Monday. Our guest today is returning for a second week, Ian Millhiser. He is the justice editor for Think Progress and the author of Injustices, the Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted. So I think even just from the title of his book, you can guess why I invited him back today. So Ian, thank you for sitting down with me again.
We really need to stop meeting this way.
Seriously. I know, I emailed you. I was like, I really wish I was asking to talk to you under better circumstances. This is awful. So,
Yeah, so bad.
So I want to start right away with, I remember last week you even said there's two more decision days. There's more shit coming down the pike.
Right.
So I want to ask you about those decisions. So there was Janus, there was the travel ban, and then there was the Becerra versus some bullshit pro-life group. I don't even care.
Yeah, like NIFLA, I think is the acronym. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm glad that the acronym for that is just as fucking ridiculous as the group itself.
Yeah.
It sounds like a Harry Potter animal.
I'm pretty sure they're all Death Eaters.
Okay, so I kind of want to start with those three. It's a lot. They're a lot. Very complicated cases. But what I was struck by is that all three deal with the First Amendment. So can you kind of thread that through for us and explain, based on these three decisions, what the court has said about the First Amendment?
Yeah, I mean, one of the most important trends we've seen in the Roberts Court is this effort to weaponize the First Amendment, which, you know, it's supposed to be about speech, and turn it into a, like, sort of vehicle for conservative activism. Right. So, like, I think that was most on display in the unions case, in the Janus case. The issue here is that, like, so you have a legal right if you're in a unionized workplace, if you're a public sector unionized workplace, you don't have to join the union. But what the unions can do, or at least used to be able to do, is that they could require non-members to reimburse them for the services that they provide a non-member. So the union bargains on behalf of everyone, not just the members. If you're a non-member and the union bargains for a raise, you get that raise too, and not just the members of the union. If you have a grievance, then, like, you know, that helps maintain the collective bargaining agreement, and you know, you benefit from that as well. So you have to reimburse the union for the services that it provides you. What the Supreme Court said yesterday is that, oh, no, now the unions have to provide their services for free.
Right.
Yep. And, like, you can imagine how great that's going to be for the union's finances, that they now are no longer getting money for very expensive services that they're providing some non-members. The theory of the case was that these are public sector unions, and when you bargain, that's a form of speech. You know, one person says, I want a 3% raise, and the other person says, no, you only get a 2% raise, and, you know, you figure it out. So that's a form of speech.
Sure.
And for that reason, the state could not enter into a contract that requires someone to reimburse the union for the speech that the union is doing in the bargaining session. So that's how they made it into a First Amendment case. Yeah, there's a lot of problems with this theory. I mean, the big, really scary thing about this theory is that every conversation, like every labor law, can be boiled down to in some way to speech. You know, a minimum wage law is a ban on negotiating for very low wages. A law requiring an employer to provide health benefits is a ban on negotiating for a job that doesn't include health care.
Right.
So you can characterize pretty much any labor law as a ban on negotiations, which therefore means the First Amendment applies. And so if you take this case to its logical end, it just means we don't have protections for workers anymore.
Right, right. Now, I was also struck from what I understood is that the concept of these union fees or reimbursing them for their services was also part of the First Amendment argument in that the way you use your money is part of your free speech right? Free speech rights? Was that part of that?
Right, yes. So the idea is that unions are being reimbursed. Like the big cost for union is that collective bargaining is really expensive. I mean, you know, the union has to hire lawyers to conduct the negotiations. They need to hire, you know, people who are just experts in negotiating. Often there's like people have to go through the balance sheets and, you know, have to make economic assessments about what they realistically can ask for. And, you know, that requires expensive employees. You know, that requires people with very specialized skills who cost money to hire. And what the old rule was that the union can be reimbursed for, you know, each individual person who benefits from that bargaining has to reimburse the union for their fair share of what it costs.
Got it.
And, you know, the idea is to prevent free riders. You know, you don't want a situation, you know, if you can get something for nothing, if I tell you, hey, you can either give me 50 cents for this cookie or I'll give it to you for free.
Right.
You're going to take the free cookie.
Sure. Sure.
And so the problem is you're going to wind up with workplaces where everyone takes the free cookie until the union doesn't have any money and it collapses financially, and then no one benefits from the union.
Right, right. So it's a roundabout way of blasting through the union's rights and the union's powers.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. The purpose here is to defund the union.
Right, sure.
And the way that they've done it is that they've attacked a major source of the union's finances by characterizing this as a case about free speech, by saying that employment negotiations are First Amendment protected activity. And, you know, again, if that's true, you know, if they really take that theory seriously, that any negotiation about employment is a First Amendment matter, things are going to get really scary really, really fast.
Sure. So I want to continue this theme of First Amendment free speech rights into the NIFLA case.
Yep.
And then the travel ban is all obviously the big overarching thing. And then I want to talk a little bit about the Kennedy retirement, too. So lots to get to. So with NIFLA, the basic argument was that California was restricting the free speech rights of crisis pregnancy centers by saying you have to tell your clients about that you're a non-medical facility and what legal medical procedures are available to you, i.e. abortion. So the Supreme Court found that violates the crisis pregnancy center's right to free speech. Did I get that?
Yeah. I mean, there's a bit of a distinction in the law because there's crisis pregnancy centers that provide no medical care whatsoever, and there's crisis pregnancy centers that provide some medical care, and like they just don't do abortions and contraception. And so, you know, they're slightly different, but yeah, the idea was that the crisis pregnancy centers had to post a notice that in some cases it informed women of the availability of abortion services, and often, you know, the purpose of the law was to make sure that the crisis pregnancy center disclosed what it wasn't.
Right.
You know, it was to prevent people from going into these places thinking that they are abortion clinics, because like that's what the scam is. The scam is that You build something that looks a lot like an abortion clinic, and you give it a title with the word pregnancy in the name, and people will show up who need abortions, and then you just try to run out the clock on them. You keep trying to divert them until suddenly their pregnancy is too far along to have a legal abortion.
Yep. I mean, I was Googling crisis pregnancy centers to research the case. Oh, shit. The stuff that came up, the websites for these crisis pregnancy centers are, I mean, they're basically lying to you. And so how that's protected by free speech really confuses me. So,
yeah.
And the lawyer in this case for NIFLA, she said something to the effect is, she's seeing this as a win for Americans of faith. So she framed it as a religious freedoms case, saying that it goes against our religion to tell women about abortions, and therefore you're violating our right to religion.
Right. Yeah. I mean, she tried to bring that up, but I mean, you know, I don't really. There weren't five votes for that. I mean, the court saw it as a free speech case, and like, I mean, I will be honest with you. I thought this was a hard case. Mm-hmm. But there's a very particular reason I thought it was a hard case. So, like, it's well established that, like, the government typically can't force you to deliver the government's message. So, like, you know, the forced speech cases, like, those are very common. But there's been a big exception to that, and that is abortion providers. So,
right,
like, you know, all these states now, like, if you want to get an abortion, the doctor has to read this script, and often the script is just a bunch of anti-abortion rhetoric. You know, there's, like, I think there's several states where the doctor has to say, oh, yeah, and your child is a human life from the moment it's conceived. And, like, you know, in some cases, the doctors have to give very questionable information. I think, like, there might have been a state where they had to tell you that, like, abortion causes breast cancer, which it doesn't.
It does not.
Right. But, I mean, setting aside when they're telling doctors to tell outright lies, often these scripts are just anti-abortion advocacy. It's the state requiring the doctor to tell something, to tell the person to try to talk them out of getting an abortion.
Right. So it's a little rich to then be like, okay, but you can't, it doesn't work in reverse.
Exactly. And so, like, the reason I thought this was a hard case is you should just have the same rule for both sides.
Right.
You know, like, if it's okay for Texas to force an abortion doctor to read an anti-abortion script, then it should also be okay for California to force a crisis pregnancy center to disclose what they're up to. You know, so that's one rule that I think would be fair. Another rule that I think would be fair is to say that you can't have either law. So the California law gets struck down, but you also strike down Texas's law that requires doctors to read this terrible script. But what the Supreme Court said instead was that we have one First Amendment if you support abortion, and we have a different, much better First Amendment if you oppose abortion.
Right. That's also what struck me about these cases, is that it felt like the court was deciding who the First Amendment was for and the limitations of that power based on who you are or what your beliefs are. And I think that segues directly into this travel ban / Muslim ban, which I think was the most disheartening of these decisions. Though, as an American who has been pregnant, NIFLA personally offended me. But that's just neither here nor there. But the travel ban case, really, you know, they were trying to frame it as a presidential power issue and not interfering with national security, but not taking into account what Trump has said for longer context. So, and I know that they, in all of this mess, they also overturned a case called Korematsu, and which had allowed...
They overruled and simultaneously reaffirmed Korematsu.
Right, exactly. That was what Sotomayor had pointed out. So Korematsu allowed the internment of Japanese-American citizens during World War II, and it's considered to be one of the worst Supreme Court decisions in history. So they overturned that while at the same time saying, well, Trump can say that it's a Muslim ban and pretend that it's a travel ban. So was this also a free speech issue or not?
So this was under a different part of the First Amendment. This is under the Establishment Clause, which deals with, you know, when the government decides to prefer one faith over another. So the facts of this case are that Trump, as you know, promised a Muslim ban.
Right.
And then after he promised a Muslim ban, he literally gave a meet the press interview where he said, oh, our people are saying I can't say Muslim ban anymore. So what I'm going to say instead is I'm just going to ban people from a bunch of countries. And then Rudy Giuliani, Trump's current personal lawyer, said, oh, yeah, Trump told me to assemble a commission to figure out how we can do the Muslim ban. And what we came back to him with is we said, oh, the way that you do the Muslim ban is that you say you're only banning people from certain places, and then the courts will say that's legal.
Right, which so, obviously that was a strong strategy.
Yeah,
that's exactly what
turns
happened.
Out they were right. Turns out Rudy Giuliani's a better lawyer than we thought. So the facts here are: Trump said he was going to do something unconstitutional. He then told you how he was going to disguise it to make sure to make it look like it wasn't unconstitutional, and then he executed the plan that he said he was going to execute. And what the Supreme Court said is they said, well, look, this is national security. And when the president says something involves national security, we're just not going to look too deep. And so long as they give a plausible explanation for why they're doing it, we're not going to go back and probe too deeply into all the stuff that they've said, because we've just got to defer to what the president says is in the interest of our national security.
Right. So this facade of neutrality that they were talking about. So as long as
exactly.
you can put the pig in a coat of makeup, we're going to say fine.
That's exactly right. And what's interesting is it's not the first time the Supreme Court has said that. Because if you go back and you read the Korematsu decision, what Korematsu said was the Roosevelt administration tells us that it's really, really important that we round up all these Japanese people and put them in concentration camps, or Japanese Americans, I should say, and put them in concentration camps. And so, they say it's important for national security, and, we don't want to second guess them on that, so we better just go ahead and let them do it. It offended me.
Right.
There's been a conversation. I mean, Korematsu, as you said, is considered to be one of the worst decisions of all time. There's been, people have been wanting to see it overruled. And frankly, the reason why it's never been overruled is because it's such a discredited decision that no other president did something that would allow someone to bring the case that would allow for Korematsu to be overruled.
Right. Okay. So it was dead in the water and not really addressed.
Yeah. And so now in Korematsu 2.0,
yeah,
they're going to tell us that they're getting rid of the case. I mean, it's just, there's something cruel and abusive about it. I mean, I don't like being gaslit by the Chief Justice of the United States.
Right, right. Yeah, I was just going to say, it feels very gaslighty. Like, oh, we're overturning this, but we're actually reaffirming it. But, it's fine. Look over here at this shiny thing.
I also
want to talk, because Kennedy wrote a very short concurring opinion on the travel ban case. And it was sort of like a self-indulgent, I'm a tortured soul, I didn't want to vote for this kind of thing. Why? I mean, what was Kennedy's purpose in writing this, I'm really a good person, even though I just voted for a Muslim ban?
Yeah, I mean, this was a very hard term. I mean, normally there's Kennedy votes with the liberals every now and then. He more often than not votes with the conservatives. But normally there's a few cases where you peel off Kennedy and something good happens. And in every single case where the four liberals were on one side and the four most conservative justices were on the other side, Kennedy voted with the conservatives 100% of the time this term. And when I look back at the whole term, when I look back at him not deciding gerrymandering, at him not deciding the anti-gay cake baker case, at him voting with the conservatives and all these decisions, and then writing this ridiculous opinion in Korematsu 2.0, where he says, I don't really want to do this, but I'm powerless to stop it. He made the decision to retire months ago. It's clear that he was checked out. He decided that he was going to spend his last year on the Supreme Court in a senior slump. And having decided that he was going to coast through his last year as the most powerful judge on the planet, He then realized, I could vote my conscience in these cases, but if I do, they're just going to be overruled 5 minutes later when I'm gone. So I'm just going to make it easy and not cause the court to hand out a bunch of opinions that the new majority is going to disagree with next year. I mean, that's what I think was going on. And it's cowardly. It's, I think, empirically not actually the case that, when a new majority comes in, they immediately overrule everything else. I mean, the Roberts Court is pretty bad, but there's plenty of stuff that I thought they were going to overrule right away that they haven't gotten around to. And the fact that it hasn't been overruled for 13 years really matters, because people have had better lives for 13 years because of that. And it's just, and I'm sorry, if your job is Associate Justice of the United States Supreme Court, you don't get a senior slump.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like that's exactly what it's felt like, where it's like, oh, I'm just going to fuck around for a little bit. It's like, that's not how this works. Like, you're not some insurance claims adjuster who's retiring in 3 months. Like, that's not how this works. So with Kennedy retiring, and he's made this it's clear he made this decision months ago. Do you think that the Senate is going to follow this McConnell rule that excluded Merrick Garland from even getting a hearing?
Oh, hell no, because the McConnell rule was bullshit.
Right.
I mean, no one believed in it. McConnell doesn't believe in the McConnell rule. The McConnell rule was the I don't like Barack Obama rule.
Right, right.
And Barack Obama isn't president anymore, so it no longer applies.
Right.
Things are grim, I'm not going to lie to you, but there is still a path to blocking Trump's nominee, and that is the nominee will have a vote, and if a majority of the senators vote no, then the nominee is rejected. And there are at least two Republican senators, Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski, who claim to be pro-choice.
Yeah. I mean, Susan Collins got an award from Planned Parenthood. I mean, I'm heartened by Susan Collins. And also, I've said this before, I respect the hell out of Lisa Murkowski. I don't agree with a lot of her policies, but I think that she is principled, and I do have faith in her.
Yeah, and she also won an election in a write-on campaign.
I say this all the time. Yeah. I'm like, you want a bad bitch? She got primaried out of her seat and then won in a write-in campaign, and her last name is Murkowski. Like, that's hard to spell.
Exactly. They had to teach people how to spell her name.
Yeah, don't come for Lisa Murkowski.
Yeah, and so she's the one Republican senator who doesn't have to worry about the right-wing base.
Right.
Because if they come at her again, she'd be like, remember what happened the first time?
Yeah, right, you really want to do this?
You want to roll? Let's roll.
Let's roll.
So here's the thing. Murkowski doesn't have to worry about the right wingers. Susan Collins is the senator from a blue state. She is the United States senator from Maine. And what both of them need to understand is if you vote yes on this nominee, you are voting to overrule Roe v. Wade. You're voting for a lot of other things, too, but you have voted that Roe v. Wade shall be overruled. That is the vote you are casting. And Susan Collins can run for re-election in 2020 in a blue state, and she can either be the senator who killed Roe v. Wade, or she can be the senator who saved Roe v. Wade. And, it's up to her to decide in a blue state which one of those she wants to be.
That's why I'm heartened by all of this. This is obviously a lot of very depressing shit coming at us, but I do feel that it not all hope is lost completely. I don't know. Maybe I'm just being a Pollyanna pants over here, but I'm trying to keep the faith that there are people who care about this.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be grim, and the most likely outcome is very bad. But at the same time, on election day, I remember thinking, Christ, there's no way in hell we save Obamacare. And the best we can hope for is that we stop Paul Ryan from turning Medicare into a voucher program and cutting Medicaid in half. I would have considered it a win on the like the night that Donald Trump was elected if like at this point in history we only lost Obamacare. And fortunately, I had some colleagues who were smarter than me and realized that, like, no, we can fight and we can save this thing. And for the most part, they did.
And that was largely really Collins and Murkowski again, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it was Collins, Murkowski, and McCain. And McCain's out of the picture now because he's off in Arizona. So, so things are really fucking grim right now.
Yeah.
But, like, bear in mind that we have been in very grim circumstances before and achieved an outcome that I would not have thought possible.
You also said something in a piece you wrote about all of this crap that Justice Kennedy was the worst justice and his last decision was his worst. Basically, I'm paraphrasing.
So, yeah, I don't think I called him the worst, but he's
a bad judge.
Terrible.
You didn't call. Yeah, that's right. You called him terrible. Not the worst. That's fair. Not the worst. But his last decision was his worst. So, you know, Kennedy was largely seen as sort of like a benevolent dictator as a swing vote on the Supreme
right.
Court. He had a couple of really great decisions and a couple of really shitty ones. So, I mean, do you think that losing Kennedy is going to be as fatalistic as it feels right now?
I mean, if Trump gets to pick who he wants to replace Kennedy, things are going to get really, really bad. I mean, Kennedy was bad on most things. I mean, like, let us not celebrate Anthony Kennedy. Like, Kennedy was stoked about that opinion nuking unions that we were just talking about. Kennedy wrote the fucking Citizens United decision. So, like, you know, let us not put this man on a pedestal. But, you know, he also wrote every single one of the court's major gay rights decisions, and not just the marriage equality decision. I mean, before I think 2003, if you were gay, it was okay to arrest you for having sex.
Right, right, right.
There is no longer a majority on the Supreme Court now for the proposition that gay people are allowed to have sex. And, he did some, there were some racial justice decisions, he wasn't great on affirmative action, but when he had the chance to kill it, he didn't. He saved the Fair Housing Act, which the other four conservatives on the court wanted to largely gut.
Although he did gut the Voting Rights Act.
Yeah. I mean, he's done a lot of really terrible stuff, but like there's a lot of terrible stuff that couldn't happen that did not happen. He said we can't execute children. And he preserved, some shell of Roe v. Wade. And, so you could tell two stories about him. You could tell the good story, or you could tell the story about all the stuff he did to help rich people at the expense of everyone else in the country. And Kennedy could have had one of two choices to make. He could retire under Donald Trump and lose all of the civil rights stuff, lose all the, the gay rights opinions, the good racial justice opinions, all of that. Or he could wait a little while and retire under, who knows who it's going to be, Kamala Harris, Kirsten Gillibrand, whoever's next, and lose Citizens United. He decided he cared more about Citizens United. He cared more about Sheldon Adelson being able to write million-dollar checks to elect Republicans than he did about whether or not gay people are human beings.
Yeah, I mean, Kennedy is Kennedy is Kennedy. And again, like, I know I asked you about this last week, but the sort of partisanship of the judicial system, I feel like, is in sharp relief these days, and that a lot of people are saying, this guy's a Republican, he's a lifelong Republican, he was never going to retire while there was a Democratic president.
Right.
So, well, Ian, thank you so much for sitting down with me again. You really clarified a lot of these cases for us, and like I said, it is pretty bleak, but I do have hope.
Yeah, I hope that someday we'll be able to chat about happy news.
That would be great. Like, let's get a SCOTUS decision that we love, and then we can come on and have a chat about that.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I'm actually scheduled to do an interview this afternoon where we decided that we're going to bring a bottle of tequila.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Varsha yesterday was like, I took a shot of tequila at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Like, that's my life right now.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, all right, Ian, well, thank you again. And I will talk to you later, hopefully under better circumstances.
All right. Well, I will look forward to that.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, Hellions, that is it for me. Thank you so much for sticking with us to the end. This was a really, really long episode, but I think we covered a lot of really important ground. And again, thank you to Ian, who was so helpful in clarifying and discussing some of the stuff that's come out of SCOTUS in recent times. Like I said, it's I don't think we've ever had a double guest before, at least consecutively, and we definitely haven't had a white dude this much on the show, but he was really wonderful and very helpful. So Varsha and I, like I said before, will be back here on Monday. In the meantime, have a great weekend. Go to the protests against family separation. Like I said, I'll be in the one downtown LA. Raise some hell, and let's all work on our empathy, because we all need some empathy right now.